Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
College and university life is one of the primary ways in which Americans kind of decide who's who.
Deconstructing the college admissions rat race.
You spend all of this time when you write an application sort of turning yourself into a file.
Colleges madly recruit applicants and then turn almost all of them down.
It's kind of like a nightclub, actually. The nightclub is as desirable as the proportion of partygoers it turns away.
Does the admission process really make sense?
One of the great virtues of the American higher education system is there are lots of different ways to be excellent.
Our guest is Mitchell Stevens, author of Creating a Class, College Admissions and the Education of Elites.
Recorded in front of a live high school audience in Palo Alto, California.
Deconstructing the college admissions rat race.
Once you get into college, it's going to be a lot easier.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today, we're recording the program in front of a live audience of students from Gunn and Pali High Schools in Palo Alto, California.
Our thinking begins just across the street at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today, deconstructing the college admissions rat race.
Getting into the college or university of your choice, especially if it's a highly selective one, has become more daunting and more stress-inducing than ever before.
And John, you know, the odds are really stacked against students from the start. Consider Stanford, our own university. This year, we had just over 32,000 applicants to fill about 1,600 freshman slots. We ended up accepting just 7% of those who applied.
Those are astounding numbers.
Yeah, and Stanford's not alone. It's the same thing all over the country. Harvard admitted 7% of its applicants, Yale 8%, Princeton admitted a whopping 9% of its applicants, and they all have 25,000 to 30,000 applicants. Imagine trying to process 30,000 college files.
Now, to be fair, and to not distort the reality of the thing, that's not the whole story. There are many fine colleges and universities that admit a significantly higher proportion of their applicants. There are excellent options, particularly in California, where you have the junior colleges, the state colleges, and the wonderful universities. One of the greatest universities in the world, the University of California, Berkeley, for example, admitted 22% of the 48,000 who applied.
So Berkeley is three times less competitive than Stanford? That explains a lot. That explains a whole lot.
Typical Stanford snobbiness. And the University of Michigan, another great university, admitted over half of its applicants.
Okay, John, you made a good point. And in all seriousness, I think it is a great thing about America that if you want to go to college, there is a school somewhere that will accept you. And it'll probably do a very good job of educating you, too.
That's true. I mean, there was even a school that accepted me.
Yeah, there you go.
And the proof of the pudding is in the pudding or something. So there's a college out there for everyone. But that really makes it all the more puzzling. Why is there such intense competition over the relatively few spots in the so-called elite colleges and universities?
Well, John, I think that's a good question, but I think the answer is kind of obvious. The problem is that our society is obsessed, I mean, extraordinarily obsessed with pedigree and prestige. I mean, deep in their heart of hearts, many people believe, I bet you some of the students in this audience believe, that the prestige of the college you go to will make an enormous difference to the rest of your life, an enormous difference.
You know, hardly anyone stops to ask whether that belief is true. But whether or not it's true, the bare fact that it's believed gives selective colleges and universities a perverse incentive to be even more selective.
Right, because people take selectivity as a signal of pedigree and prestige.
Which makes prestige-hungry students and their parents even more eager to apply.
And more crestfallen when they don't get in.
It's a vicious circle. Increased applications means more selectivity, which means higher prestige, which means more applications, which means yada yada, you get the idea.
Well, yeah, and not only is it a vicious circle, it's a costly circle. As the competition for admission has intensified, the pressure on students, pressure to be more, achieve more, that's intensified too.
The pressure starts early as elementary school, and continues without let-up. Now, there are a lot of advantages to a place like Stanford. They're the best-looking philosophy professors in the world. It's right next to Pali High. It's not far from Gun High. But even with all those advantages, I'm not sure all this pressure to get into places like Stanford is a good or healthy thing.
I'm pretty sure it's not a good or healthy thing. I mean, look, it leaves many students, even highly successful students, stressed out and burned out.
Or worse. Here in Palo Alto, for example, there was a rash of student suicides. I don't know that the relentless pressure to excel was a direct cause, but I wouldn't be surprised if it played a role.
Yeah, you know, John, somebody needs to stop and ask some tough questions about this. We need to deconstruct the college admissions rat race. What do we really get by subjecting teenagers to such intense pressure to achieve in the first place?
Do we distort their lives? To what end? Whose interests are really served by the way college admissions rat race is currently structured?
Those are some very good questions, John, but you know, I'm afraid they're a little above my pay grade.
Well, I hope they're not above the pay grade of our guest.
That would be Mitchell Stevens, author of Creating a Class, College Admissions and the Education of Elites. He'll be joining us in a bit.
And we're very eager for questions and insights from our audience of high school students, many of whom are still navigating the admissions process.
But first, a roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, looks into the psychological toll of all this pressure from the college rat race. She files this report.
There's a well-known scene from the television show Saved by the Bell. Overachiever Jessie Spano is caught abusing caffeine pills so she can stay awake studying and practicing for performance.
You mean you really are taking drugs?
I need them.
Jessie, give me those.
I need them back. I have to sing.
Jessie, you can't sing tonight.
Yes, I can. I'm so excited.
There is a life or death feeling to a lot of this.
Lisa DiMarino is a marriage and family therapist in Palo Alto, California. She says teenagers today are under even more pressure to get good grades and go to top colleges than when that episode first aired back in 1990.
You know, they kind of get in this mode of, well, if I can't do it, I can't do anything else and my life is over.
Most of us have tasted rejection. But when you're 17 and that letter comes telling you you didn't get into your first pick college, the pain can be especially brutal.
What was your top choice when you were applying to undergraduate schools?
It was probably Harvard.
Did you get in?
No, I didn't.
My top pick was UCLA, the art major there, and they don't take a lot of people, and I didn't get in.
Yet as much as it hurts, the pain doesn't last. And many people say getting rejected turns out to be a good thing.
I wanted to go to my next best choice, which was UC Berkeley, and I'm so glad that I didn't get into UCLA because I love Berkeley, and I don't know what my life would be like over there in LA.
I think it turned out to be a great decision. Texas was a fun school, and got to stay close to home.
People get laid off, people get fired, you know, businesses close. Rejection is part of life.
DiMarino works with teenagers going through the college application process. She says the pressure to succeed can lead to somatic disorders.
There's kids that are getting ulcers, that are getting migraines, that are not eating, not sleeping. Some of them just kind of freeze and give up.
And then there are the more extreme cases involving panic attacks, depression, substance abuse, and even suicide.
They end up staying up all night and then drinking coffee or sometimes taking even more hardcore substances to be able to stay on top of things and get all their work done. You know, I think that they definitely, there's a lot of the, well, I'll work really hard all week and then I'll blow it off on the weekend. And again, a lot of maybe binge drinking and some other risky behaviors.
The family therapist says applying to college can be just as stressful for the straight A student as it is for the slacker.
You know, I had a girl in my office last week that was literally sobbing over her math grade. And I said, well, you know, what are you going to get? I'm thinking she's going to say an F, she said a B. And I thought, you know, and I said to her, nobody ever died from a B in math. But to her, it was a life and death situation.
With dwindling resources and rising rejection rates, DiMarino says the better school districts are breeding more stressed out kids, with pressure coming from all angles, teachers, parents, even from other students.
I have a 9-year-old and he told me yesterday, well, I'm gonna go to Stanford, so I have to do really good on my animal project. And I said, whoa, like rewind. So I'm thinking, I know I'm not putting this stress on him, but he's hearing this from other kids.
This bothers DiMarino. She believes kids need room to fail and room to grow, and that the leaders of tomorrow don't need to be perfect today. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor, coming to you from Palo Alto High School, just across from the Stanford campus. Our audience is made up of high school students.
And we're joined now by Mitchell Stevens. He's a professor in the School of Education at Stanford University, and he's author of a really cool book called Creating a Class, College Admissions and the Education of Elites. Mitchell, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Mitchell, for your book, you actually went out into the field, so to speak, and hung out in a college admissions office for a year. You observed firsthand how admissions officers create a class, to use your phrase. Tell us a little bit about what that was like.
Well, it turned my sense of higher education in the United States upside down. And wow. The reason it did was because, like probably a lot of people in this room, I had presumed that because schools that admitted a small proportion of their applicants just kind of sat back and waited for the letters to come in. But in fact, they worked their tails off making sure that they had the large number of applicants that they could subsequently turn away. So so the colleges, the admissions officers were working as hard as the students were to get the application numbers up.
So how many applicants did this school, do you know?
The school that I studied admitted about a third of its applicants each year. So it was less selective than Stanford, but more selective than the great majority of schools in this country. I think it's important to remember that it's really a tiny minority of schools that admit fewer than half of their applicants, maybe 200 at the outset. So the schools that we're really worrying about are a tiny minority of the thousands of schools in the country.
So I think things have changed. When I applied to go to college in 1959, I filled out a 2 or 3 page thing, I think attached $5, and by return mail, I was admitted.
Well, it costs $10 now.
Yeah. What's the main difference between, but I think even if I'd tried for a first-rate place like Harvard, it would have been a lot different.
So what's the main difference?
How have things changed between then and now?
The big thing that's changed, I would argue, is the character of the economy in the United States. So when you went to college, it was more or less presumed that a college degree could be converted pretty quickly or easily into a financially secure middle-class or upper-middle-class job. That's simply not true anymore. So it's become much more difficult to secure middle-class comforts in this country and to secure them over the course of adulthood.
How has the way colleges go about this briefly changed, though, about admitting their class? Has that changed much?
That's a good question. The way in which U.S. colleges and universities, and this is important to remember, too, the way that selective schools like Stanford go about evaluating applicants is peculiar internationally. So this idea that you're supposed to be good on test scores and class rank and GPA and also be a special individual at the same time is something that most of the rest of the world doesn't bother with. I would say that the routine for evaluation is pretty comparable. The big thing that's changed is the competitiveness.
Right. So do you think this competitiveness, is it just admissions? My sense, teaching 40 years at UCLA and Stanford, is the whole place is competitive to a sick degree. Departments are competitive. They want to be the best philosophy department or the best chemistry department.
Well, let me tell you.
In my stays in Europe, I just don't see that.
Well, I'll just say I've been at Stanford for 3 years, and the first 2 years I'm here, I'm glad that I had a really good therapist because it is an extremely intense place. Certainly not just for undergraduate admissions, but the whole place is very competitive. And I would argue that that's what being successful in the United States at this moment in history now requires.
This is a special edition of Philosophy Talk. We're deconstructing the college admissions rat race with Mitchell Stevens from Stanford School of Education in the company of an audience of students from Gunn and Pally High Schools in Palo Alto, California.
We've been talking about the way the college admissions process has changed over the years. We'll continue talking about that. But we're also going to turn a critical eye on the admissions grind. We're going to ask whether it's distorting the lives of young people. And if it distorts the way we adults educate and parent our young people.
What is the college admissions rat race doing to our young? A first-hand perspective from our live and lively young audience of high school students when Philosophy Talk continues.
20 years, you look back at photos of yourself and recall in a way you can't grasp now how much possibility lay before you and how fabulous you really looked. You are not as fat as you imagine.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. What sort of advice should we be giving to teenagers about getting into college? I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're deconstructing the college admissions rat race with Mitchell Stevens, author of Creating a Class, College Admissions and the Education of Elites.
How has the grind of college admissions changed the way we educate and parent our young? What does this process say about our values and aspirations? How do teenagers cope with all of this pressure and stress? And is this whole process, on balance, a good or a bad thing? We have a live audience of high school students, and we invite them to join in the discussion by stepping up to one of the microphones at either end of the stage.
So, Mitchell, but let's start this segment by asking. So I'm focusing on the more selective colleges. Mm-hmm. You said that college you're at was trying to increase the numbers.
Yes.
I think that's because more numbers means more selectivity and more people want to apply and all good
things. Yes, state. And more prestige.
Right, right. Yeah. But I want to ask you, so why do colleges and universities do things the way they do, these selective? What core values and beliefs lie behind this, the whole pressure-inducing system?
Well, this is a 100-year-old story in the United States. Actually, there are so many colleges and universities in the United States, and there have been for so long, that colleges themselves have long been uncertain about how to think of themselves relative to each other. We have no Oxford and Cambridge in the United States, which sort of determine who the blue ribbon class are. So over the course of many generations, colleges and universities worked out actually two systems for determining who was top and who was less top. One was selective college admission. So a school is presumed to be as good as the quality of the applicants it turns away. That's why we're in awe of places like Stanford, because so many qualified applicants are not granted admission. The other system is intercollegiate athletics, which functions kind of like tables do in a high school cafeteria. How cool are you? Well, you're as cool as the people you play sports with.
So it sounds like you're saying the reason we have selective colleges and the reason colleges want to be part of that selectivity is because they're selling themselves as tickets into the elite class, right? So if you come here, here's your ticket to an elite life.
Well, two things. It's kind of like a nightclub, actually. The nightclub is as desirable as the proportion of partygoers it turns away. And then it's partly also that college and university life is, as you say, Ken, one of the primary ways in which Americans kind of decide who's who.
But you know, there's a certain cynicism in the way you're presenting this. There are differences between colleges, among colleges, and among universities. Among colleges, some of them really are much better at teaching. Mm-hmm. I'm sure of that. I mean, I've been to colleges, I've taught at colleges, I've observed colleges. Mm-hmm. At universities, I suppose there's a difference among teaching, mm-hmm. but there's a difference in the research and the amount of grants mm-hmm. they bring in and so forth and so on. So setting aside the cynical parts and taking that, what puzzles me is why students are so anxious to get into good research universities when for most of them, the quality of undergraduate teaching will mm-hmm. be much more important. Mm-hmm.
But I think you're missing something. Colleges are selling not just education and knowledge, they're selling prestige. Mm-hmm. The great research universities have the greatest faculty, the Nobel Prize laureates. They gather together really smart students, and that's a branding thing.
Well, I know, but look, suppose I'm a rational student, I want to be a doctor. I think the best thing for me to do is go to a college where I'll get a really good pre-med education. If I go to Stanford, what happens? Well, I get into Chem 31. Chem 31 if you get through it, you'll know a lot of chemistry, but its primary function is to convince you that you're smart, not smart enough to be a pre-med at Stanford.
Well, John,
a lot of kids, I've seen a lot of kids over the years who have given up on being a pre-med because of Chem 31 at Stanford. If they'd gone to Haverford or my college, Doane College or Antioch, mm-hmm. they would have been encouraged to make the most of their potential. So why are parents and kids so interested in going to places like Stanford?
Okay, well, we're talking about a couple things at once, which is part of the fun. I would say one of the great virtues of the American higher education system is there are lots of different ways to be excellent. You can get admitted to some of the most selective colleges in the country by being an excellent lacrosse player or an excellent performance artist, or by being a very interesting weirdo. There are lots of different ways to be excellent in the United States, and we don't limit it to a single test score, as is true in most of the world. So I think it's important to realize that, you know, yes, we're focused on a very small number of schools, but there are lots of ways to be excellent in American higher education. That's not true everywhere else. The other thing that we've been talking about, I would say, is that I think there's a common tendency in life generally to look upward to people who have the somewhat nicer house or the somewhat better car or who are a little better looking than one is. And I think that's, look, we're in one of the most intense regions in the entire world. Everyone's looking up. And I think it's easy for all of us to forget that by virtue of the fact that we're even looking at this tiny piece of the world means that we're much more advantaged than the vast majority of people in this country.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about deconstructing the college admission rat race in front of an audience of high school students from Gunn and Pauley High Schools in Palo Alto, California. And we've got lots of questions from that live audience. We'd love to have you join us. We'll start on this side of the room and we'll go back and forth. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am. Tell us your name and then tell us your question.
Hi, my name is Savannah. And my mom used to work at business school admissions. And they look specifically for leadership potential. How is that different for colleges, and how does it affect the college rat race?
Well, I would say leadership is one of the great American mythologies. Everyone wants to train leaders and celebrate leaders, but if you ask what a leader is or how you would know one if you saw one, it kind of very quickly evaporates. I'm not quite sure why that's the case. I think it has something to do with the fact in the United States that we don't like the idea of some people just kind of inheriting their authority from others. So we think that, you know, leadership will sort of gradually sort of, you know, rise to the surface.
But Mitchell, I think there's a deeper thing going on here. So colleges say they're looking for leadership. They're looking for innovation. They're looking for engineering.
Oh, yeah,
they're
innovation,
looking for all kinds
too.
Of they're looking for all kinds of things that don't show up in a high school transcript.
Right.
I mean, the students who get rejected from Stanford, many of them have perfect 4.0, very high test scores, mm-hmm. right? Why do they get rejected? Well, I don't know why they get rejected, but the thing is, got 32,000 applicants for 1,600 spots. They're going to accept a few more than that because of the yield thing, but they try to make these very fine-grained distinctions, very, very fine-grained distinctions between these students. You talked about how, in your book, you talk about how they like construct the narrative mm-hmm. of the student. Mm-hmm. Tell the students about
that. Yeah, yeah. And Savannah, I want to be sure that I answer your question. I would say that the official desire for leadership is very much the same in undergraduate admissions as what your mother saw in business school. What people mean by that is pretty fuzzy. What it usually ends up meaning is, you know, was the applicant in some, you know, official position of authority prior, right? President of this, vice chair of that, co-director of this, founder of that. But what leadership means is kind of like what creativity means.
But it's by definition unclear. From your experience sitting in this college,
yes.
Tell them how they go about detecting these things.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So this is my favorite part. So you spend all of this time when you write an application sort of turning yourself into a file, okay? This is Ken Taylor, right? And you make sure that the essay is pretty and perfect, and you have all the references and all that kind of stuff. And then you push the send button, and it arrives on the table of Mitchell Stevens, the admissions officer. And then what Mitchell Stevens needs to do is turn Ken Taylor from a file back into a person, right? So I take all of these little bits and pieces of information that I have about Ken Taylor, And then I tell a story about Ken. I sort of turn him into a holographic image of himself so that I can share him with my colleagues and compare him with another applicant, like, say, Savannah. I don't know her last name. And I call this process evaluative storytelling, by which I mean, if I'm going to tell a story about Savannah, it's really good for me to have enough information about Savannah to make the story interesting. It's better if I visited her high school. It's better if she came to visit the college so I could see what she looked like and how she was in person. It's better if I have a personal relationship with her high school guidance counselor so I can get on the phone and say, is Savannah really Jesus Christ, like you said in your letter? Or is she right, like a little less Jesus Christ-like than Ken, right? One of the ways in which, you know, Palo Alto High School is really good for you guys is that it's kind of all set up for lots of good information to get into that file. That's too long of an answer to your question.
But look, the thing that strikes me is if, think, 32,000 applicants, 32,000 stories.
That's exactly right.
You know, 32,000 stories. Now, if I'm the applicant and I know there has to be a story of me, what am I going to do? I'm going to busy myself trying to construct this story of me by joining this, by joining that. That's where all this pressure comes from,
yeah.
That there has to be a story of you. It's not just test scores. There has to be a story of you. It has to distinguish you from all these other people. And it's a daunting thing.
Really.
It is. So let's get some more questions from our students here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi, my name is Jared, and it's not about my story. It's a little different. I don't know exactly what I want to study or where I want to go for college. I consider myself a bright kid, I get good grades, I work pretty hard. However, money is tight in my family, and I don't know what that means for my college options. So how do I avoid stressing out about my college experience when money feels like such an issue?
Let me give you a little advice, and then the others can too. One of the great things about America, and I think it's probably as true or more true in California than elsewhere, is you have lots of opportunities to get the brass ring. It's not like in England, or at least England of the old days, where the horse went around once and you did well on your plus fours or whatever they were called, your A minuses or something, and that was it. You know, if you didn't make it, then you weren't going to Oxford or Cambridge and you weren't going to end up anywhere. In America, it's possible to have a career like mine. I went to a second-rate high school and did a mediocre job. I got into a college that desperately needed students, mostly because I wanted to play football. I wasn't any good at football. But I got interested in academics, and so even from this nowhere high school in the middle of Nebraska, I got into a reasonably good graduate school, namely Cornell in Ithaca. From a reasonably good graduate school, I got into a pretty good university. We're talking 1960s, late 60s.
I'm sorry,
Jerry.
John.
From there, I got a good job, and I got a better job. Well, he's going to tell you that's not possible. I think it's still possible. Still possible in California. We got excellent junior colleges. The old system still works. You get from junior colleges into our really good state colleges and into Berkeley and to UCLA. And if you get it into junior college and into UCLA and into Berkeley, I think there's not much difference between that and knocking yourself out, losing sleep, telling lies on your dossier, and getting into Stanford.
What do you think about that, Mitchell?
Don't believe him. Okay. The reason you shouldn't believe John is because the state of California, like just about every other state in the union, is in chronic budget crisis. If you hadn't noticed, the University of California is costing your parents a lot more than it did their parents' parents, and the future quality and integrity of that system is very much open for question. But the answer to your question, Jared, I would say is pretty straightforward. And it's very much like the logic that I imagine your guidance counselors are saying. Have reach schools that have a range of safeties. Find the place where you are the top of the applicant pool. And there are a lot of good schools in this country where you are the top of the applicant pool.
So I still want to go back to a sort of quasi-philosophical, sociological question, though. Okay. I think what you just said is true, and what I wish what John said were true. But here's the question.
I do, too.
Do elite colleges, which are so highly selective, whose selectivity signals prestige and the marketing of prestige, do they actually deliver to their students a good that they can't get elsewhere that's going to make a huge impact on their lives or not? I mean, does getting into Harvard or Stanford matter a lot to one's life?
Yes, it does matter, but not in the ways that you might imagine. So You know, is the instruction in German literature any better at Harvard than it is at College X? You know, I don't know. Frankly, I don't care. The big difference that not getting into Harvard but completing Harvard will do relative to some other school, is it, and this is very important, especially for women, I will say, is that a college degree and its name give you two things as you move through the entire life course. First thing it gives you is you've sort of been pre-sorted for various applicant pools basically for the rest of your life. So whenever you enter or re-enter the labor force, which you will do many times, a degree from a nationally recognized school is something that sort of is an automatic signal to others. Oh, that person sat at that lunch table. Okay, maybe I will talk to her. The second thing that it does is it creates a web of relationships that you can cultivate for the rest of your life. And most importantly, it affects very significantly whom you're likely to marry and remarry. So which is not to say that you're gonna find, we call it educational assortative mating. Isn't that a great word? I see the time. And the basic idea is that people increasingly use college completion and where people went to school to kind of figure out who is an appropriate person to have sex with and ultimately to marry. So even if you don't marry someone you went to college with, 15 years later, after your first divorce, when you go back to a reunion and you met somebody who was there before, you get the idea.
Let me give a little bit a short answer directed just to the question, is there an educational advantage going to the elite? If you're really bright and you have research interests, then you really do want to get into a top research university. There's no place, there's no college, there's no second-rate university that can do what a place like Stanford can do if you've really got the capacity by the time you're a junior or senior to be doing cutting-edge research.
John?
But for most kids, if your interest in German is learning German and going to Germany, the junior college has as good German instruction as Stanford. If your interest is learning history, probably until you get to graduate school, it won't matter too much if you're working with a Pulitzer Prize winner or just somebody who knows his history very well. So whether educationally, socially, I defer to the sociologists, but educationally, whether it's worth it going to an elite university very much depends on your aims.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're deconstructing the college rat race with an audience of students from Pali and Gunn High Schools in Palo Alto, California. Our guest is Mitchell Stevens, author of Creating a Class, College Admissions and the Education of Elites.
We've been probing what values and beliefs lie behind the competitive value to get accepted to selective colleges in the 21st century. In our final segment, we'll try to imagine some better ways to handle the whole thing.
We're coming to you from Palo Alto High School, just across the street from Stanford University. We'll take more questions and comments from our racing rats, young philosophers, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to the program. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We are deconstructing the college admissions rat race with Mitchell Stevens, our colleague from Stanford University. And we've got more questions from our audience of high school students. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello. My name is Andrea Herr, and given the highly selective practice of colleges, the college admissions, are we practicing a modern type of eugenics? And is that morally right, sir?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yes, except it's not actually, if modern begins in the 19th century, then yes. So eugenics is the process of manufacturing who has babies with whom.
And, I mean, you're, the title of your book has a kind of double entendre, right? It's creating a class, that's talking about a college class, but it's also creating the upper class, the elites, right? And you think of these selective colleges as in the business of creating the elites. Now, let me ask you a question. Are elites created differently because of the way college admissions works these days than they were created before? Is there some difference in the way they're created?
Yeah, exactly. Privileged people work a lot harder now than they did 25 years ago.
Well, also, there's a lot more diversity. I mean, we may be very cynical about the admissions process, but there is no comparison. in terms of the likelihood, because of these hardworking admissions officers, of a Black or a Chicano.
Racial diversity,
or yes. of a woman, or yes. of even someone from South Dakota like Merle or Nebraska like me getting into a top flight college.
Okay,
it may be bizarre, but it does have some good effects.
So talk about that. Talk about the way. So elites have always reproduced themselves, right?
Yes.
So is the elite being reproduced in a different way and a differently structured elite than it used to be when?
Yes. Being in high school is much harder now than it was for your parents. Your lives are much more scheduled than your parents were. It's much more organized around measurable accomplishment in athletics and academics. Much more of your life is organized around getting into college than it was for your parents. Don't let me forget the silver lining.
Okay, I won't let you forget them. But we'll take another question from this side of the room.
This is more related to like the actual admissions process, but what do you guys think about the moral and ethical implications of affirmative action in terms of the college admissions process? So like giving advantages to certain like minorities, for example?
We need to clarify some terms. Affirmative action has had two meanings in America. The original meaning was take affirmative action to make sure that the pool of possible applicants is not distorted by things that are irrelevant to quality. For example, back in the 70s at UCLA was on various committees that worked on this, and what we meant by affirmative action then was if we just follow the old procedures, our applicant pool won't have anybody from traditionally Black colleges, it won't have any poor people. We can take affirmative action to change the nature of our applicant pool. I'm totally 110% in favor of that. When it comes to making the final decision, you've got the applicant pool, you've got all the information, you look at it, and you're making your decision, you say, well, they're just equal, but this guy's Black and this guy's white, let's go with the Black one. I think that's pretty dubious.
Well, it doesn't happen anymore. It can't. The Supreme Court has outlawed that.
I think that the American culture changed substantially since the 1970s. In this regard, one major change is that it became fundamentally inappropriate, illegitimate, and unethical to stratify people explicitly on the basis of race or gender. So even if I did disagree, I couldn't say it out loud on a stage in Palo Alto High School or I'd get stoned, okay? And I would say a selective colleges and universities were national leaders in that regard. So they helped to set the terms of this change in ethical presumption in the United States. And it's something that selective schools can, I think, rightfully be proud of.
Mitchell, so look, here's a moral statement. It seems to me that, I don't know if elites are good things or bad things, but they're inevitable things.
They are inevitable
things. But given that there are elites in a diverse country, it is so much better, it is so much morally preferable, socially preferable, politically preferable that elites be diverse and that they be based more on meritocracy than any other thing.
Well,
and one could believe that colleges with these highly selective admissions processes, these elite-making colleges, they're trying to be meritocratic.
Okay, well, Ken, what would have happened if Harvard, Yale, and Princeton had not change the racial composition of their entering classes in the wake of the civil rights movement? I mean, I can agree with you, but I think the counterfactual is also interesting. What would have happened if the richest and most powerful white people in the United States had not changed their tune about racial inclusion after the civil rights movement?
I think you have a conclusion you want us to draw, but
yeah,
why don't you tell us?
What conclusion do you want us to draw?
Well, I mean, being in power is much easier when people presume that you're in power legitimately.
Well, I see what you're saying.
Let me just put it this way. So basically, I think it's immoral not to try to make your applicant pool as diverse as possible. That's what I mean by affirmative action. I'm all for it. The other issue is, let's suppose I'm in charge of a college or a department that's always been white males, and it's still white males, and it's driving me crazy. Mm-hmm. And I really think it's important for the university or the college or the department that we get some diversity, and I can't seem to get it without bending the rules. Then I personally would bend the rules.
So let's get some more questions. This side of the auditorium.
So I'm Nishant, and in an engineering class I took last summer, my classmates and I ranked several colleges using the typical statistics. Each group had ranked the colleges in a different way, and even more surprising, we ranked them differently than like the U.S. World News Report. Mm-hmm. So does this signify some kind of problem with the ranking system or even our definition of elite?
Well, rankings of any sort are arbitrary. They depend on what metric you're going to use, right? Am I going to use inches or centimeters? So the big thing that U.S. News & World Report has over your rankings is that a lot of people use centimeters. So, you know, is it a better way of measuring quality than yours? It almost doesn't matter.
Let's ask a foundation.
More people do.
Mitchell, let's ask a foundational. Why are we so obsessed? So these rankings come out every year.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a big deal. People want their rankings to be high. Students want to go to the hot college. They want to know. Why are we so obsessed with these rankings? What's behind that? Help me understand
well,
that from
answer,
a sociological
my
person.
Answer, Ken, would be that, okay, your parents, I'll venture to say, your parents have your best interests at heart in the short, middle, and long term, and they increasingly understand that life is uncertain. And what they're trying to do is give you as much insurance as they possibly can that with all of those uncertainties, you're going to have the best chance you have. And they see, I think rightfully, that hedging their bets by getting you admitted to a selective college is probably a pretty good thing to do.
So
because it's something that you'll always have in your back pocket no matter what happens.
I'm starting to wonder what you see the silver lining in this is, because if I take this to its logical conclusion, this is sort of arms race, right?
Yes.
If I'm a college, I want to be the most prestigious college I can be. I want to be the most selective in one way. I get the best students. I get more and more people applying to me. I can turn down some. You know, people who get turned down from me, it's like, wow, you turned those guys down? And then more people want to apply. But on the students, that pressure to make yourself worthy on your parents, this pressure to raise them in such a way that they'll be worthy. This just sounds like an escalating arms race.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
where's the silver lining?
Okay. The silver lining is there's two parts. One, once you get into college, it's going to be a lot easier. I promise you. Whether or not it should be easy or not, it will be.
The
you
average
can pick your own classes. You can sleep as long as you want. You can, if you go to a selective one, you can drop out. You can get into trouble, and we'll try to keep you in because
that's part one. What's part two?
Okay. Part two is that by virtue of the fact that you're even sitting in this room and thinking about getting admitted to an elite college, down is not very far. I promise you, your safety school, your lowest of safety schools, is one of the most selective colleges in the country. So you're fine.
So let's take one last question from this side of the audience.
How would it hurt me if I decided to, instead of going to college, go after a more autodidactic path?
Fine. Don't be in a hurry. You don't need to go to college right now. College will be there.
I do think that's the bold thought. But, you know, colleges do this credentialing thing that you've been talking about over and over again. If you refuse to be part of this credentialing system, how can you thrive?
Yeah, you can. I mean, you know, you never have to go to school again if you don't want to.
I don't know, you mean never go to college? I mean, go to the Army first, go to the Navy first, kick around Europe for a couple of years.
For a while.
The more you know about yourself when you make this big investment in college, the more worthwhile it will probably be.
Well, on that note of avuncular advice, John, I think we should thank Mitchell for joining us. It's been a scintillating conversation, Mitchell.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Mitchell Stevens. He's a professor in the School of Education at Stanford University. He's author of Creating a Class, College Admissions and the Education of Elites.
We also want to thank everyone in our live audience for participating in the program. Give yourselves a round of applause.
So, John, you've got some strong thoughts. What are your thoughts now?
Well, I have to pull a little privilege here. I mean, I'm 68 years old. I had my first kid when I was 19, I guess. I've got 10 grandkids. I not only taught at Stanford and UCLA for 40 years, I also was a resident fellow for 10 years. I've seen a lot of kids at all stages go through this. Don't get too discouraged if some highfalutin place like Stanford turns you down. It's not the end of the world. If you end up in a place that doesn't have the best parties, ask yourself, did I go to the best parties when I was at Pali? Probably not. It doesn't take much for a party to be a lot of fun, whether it's at Minot State college in Mud Puddle, South Dakota, or Stanford. College years, you can have a lot of fun, and if you don't screw up too badly as a freshman, you can recoup as a sophomore. If you don't screw up too badly as a sophomore, you recoup as a senior. Senior's probably a good time to recoup. That's my advice.
So look, my last thought is, I think this is a complicated thing, but I do think it's a great thing about America that there are all these colleges. There are all these universities, and it's not like they don't educate. They don't turn out idiots. They turn out well-educated, functioning, successful, middle-class, upper-middle-class people from all different places. So it really does puzzle me in some ways, in some deep ways, why we are so obsessed with what you might call the marginal utility of a little bit more prestige, the extra value in that little bit more prestige.
I just want to point out that Ken is chairman of a program at Stanford, one of whose graduates just made $50 billion in one day.
Well, but this is a complicated question, and this conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can also find out more by visiting our very active Facebook page.
And guess what? This is really exciting. You can sign up to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org. For the final word, we apply for early bird admission from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, when I was a boy, there were no seatbelts, no crash helmets. If you wanted to get lost in the wilderness, you had to do it with a map, not GPS. The phones didn't come to us. We had to go to them. And our phones weren't smart. They had no idea what we wanted. The phone just sat there, nailed to the kitchen wall, and if it rang, it was usually bad news. Only 3 channels on the television. If we didn't like what we were watching, we couldn't log in and leave an anonymous, snarky comment. All we could do was scream at the TV. I tell you, kids, we had it rough. But one thing we did have in abundance were jobs. Not now, whether you get into the school of your choice and get the best grades in the history of recorded time, or you're stuck at your local junior college taking remedial English from an overly friendly bearded teacher who wants you to call him Ernie, your odds of getting a job are exactly the same, zero. Here are some jobs that have vanished. Telephone operator, secretary, key punch operator, gas station attendant, theater usher, cobbler, copy boy, journalist, rock star, pin setter, bookbinder, travel agent, encyclopedia salesman, elevator operator, photo lab technician, the list goes on and on. Unless you have your career sights set on being a hedge fund manager or a Navy SEAL, there's not much out there. My advice to you, get rich, quick. I don't know how you'll do that. Maybe come up with the next Facebook, murder your rich parents, or marry a prince, but I really don't see any other way out for you. And even wealth is now fraught with danger. I read an Atlantic magazine of a new study called The Joys and Dilemmas of Wealth out of Boston College's Center on Wealth and Philanthropy, sponsored by the Gates Foundation and the Templeton Foundation. It conducted among 125 wealthy families a study which found that the rich are dissatisfied. They don't feel financially secure. They also feel emotionally insecure, like they can't complain about things or they'll seem ungrateful. Friends and relatives constantly hit them up for money. There's the threat of being kidnapped. They hate birthdays and holidays because they are expected to give extravagant presents. They worry about their kids. Will they grow up to be spoiled, entitled brats? And what about marriage itself? Do they love you or just your money? Strangely, many unhappy wealthy gain a degree of happiness through philanthropy, giving their money away. Witness the sponsors of this study, the Gates Foundation, set up by Microsoft's Bill Gates, and the John Templeton Foundation. John Templeton became a millionaire through the development of diversified global mutual funds. That money enabled his foundation, which, quote, serves as a philanthropic catalyst for discoveries relating to the big questions of human purpose and ultimate reality, unquote. It's a straight line from Andrew Carnegie, who spent his wealth building libraries, or J. Paul Getty, who used his wealth to fund one of the world's great art museums. That list, too, goes on. Apparently, you have to be a hard-hearted businessman in order to get the money to melt your heart and give the money away to fund studies about the contentment level of the wealthy. I'd like to pretend I understand it, but I don't. So if you do get rich, please give generously to the Help Ian Scholes Understand Stuff Fund. Operators are standing by. Well, not operators. It's a voicemail system. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2011.
Our executive producer is David Demeris. Special thanks to Lucy Philpool, Henry Weiland, Ethan Cohen, Heather Gaia, and Jordan Heising.
Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Caitlin Esch, Merle Kessler, David Millar, and Corey Goldman.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Ben Hirsch is our director of research. Leo Weiss is our webmaster.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, the Templeton Foundation,
and from the members of KALW Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.